Very good. So if you'd like to please all get comfortable, and then I can start the talk. Is there any sound, or is the sound not working? No, it's come back on again. Can we get enough sound? Can you hear at the back or not? If you can hear at the back, put your hand up. No one can hear. Sound? Oh, you can. Okay. Over there they can hear. They're deaf at the over here. Back over there? Yes, you can hear. Okay, very good. Okay, for this evening's talk, once again, someone asked last couple of weeks ago for this particular talk, and I thought when I came here, nah, I don't want to give that talk, but then they've come today, so I promise, so I'm stuck. So it's an interesting talk, but it's a difficult one to put in such a way that everybody can understand and have meaning. Because those of you who have studied Buddhism and know a lot about it know that one of the core teachings which the Buddha taught was dependent origination. Now, if you really want to get the full works on dependent origination, please come to one of the sutta studies. Here I'm going to move it around a little bit and to consolidate it, because the main reason for this particular teaching was a very deep and profound teaching of showing people where they came from and how they got here. Usually it is about how this whole process of reincarnation actually works. Why you've come here, and how you've come here, and what you're doing once you're here. And obviously that assumes that many people accept that you have lived before and you're going to live afterwards. If you don't believe me, when you die, you can come back and say, see, I told you, I've gone. But if you come back again, and you come and haunt me, I'm going to tell you, I told you so. Now look, there is so much evidence of that about. Just to go quickly through the evidence that reincarnation, rebirth actually is, there are many people alive today who can remember their past lives, either spontaneously, because they just remember that when they're born, or people who do this hypnotic regression, which is becoming very popular, where you go into deep hypnosis and you imagine usually the old one about the staircase going down and there's a door at the end and you open that door and you go through and what do you see? A lot of people get previous lives that way. Not everybody, but some people do enough which have a very good recall of what actually happened. And there's actually one guy here who did that recently, but he, you know, I don't want to sort of say the full story without his permission, but it was incredible what he remembered. And just a little piece about it, he remembered previous life 150 years ago here in West Australia. He knows where his grave is, and he's going to go visit in a few days. He died when he was 78. His grave is still here. And he knows where it is, and it's there. So imagine how spooky that would be, going to see your own grave. That's me under there. But it's actually true. No joke. And there's many people like that. I'm sure you've seen them on the YouTube and on the TV. There's also people who get their recollection of past lives again through deep meditation. There's some others who they have these near-death experiences floating up outside of their body. They know that just when the body dies, no, something carries on. Now, there's so much evidence about that. So I'm going to, if you don't agree with that, get on YouTube, get on the internet, and there's so much stuff there. And especially if you have a friend, someone you know you trust, then it's quite obvious it's so true. But one of the problems is not just gathering the evidence of people who can remember their past lives, checking up the details and confirming, yeah, that could not have been got information not got from any other place, but also say, how does it happen? Why does it happen? and to understand why this Buddha gave this teaching, dependent origination, how cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, goes past the death of this body and goes into your next life. Now, the first thing we have to talk about to understand this is actually the nature of this thing we call the mind. The body is one thing, the mind is something else. And the mind is not something which is some byproduct of the brain. Many years ago in Sheffield University, there was Professor John Lauber. This was about 30 years ago. It was actually an article printed, I think, in Nature magazine. And his speciality was the anatomy of the human skull. And if he found anybody whose skull shape was slightly abnormal, he would invite them into his research program. And because he was at a big university in the UK, he had all these students he passed on the campus every day if he noticed anybody whose head was slightly abnormal. He'd invite them into his program. And this is how he found this one boy who was an honors, he'd graduated with honors in mathematics. So he was one smart cookie. But when he brought him into the program, he noticed his head was slightly deformed. When he brought him into the program, one of the first things he did was give him a scan of his brain to find out how his brain was. And when the results of the scan came out, he found there was no brain. It was full of this cranial fluid with only 1% of the usual amount of cortex. There was something there, but nowhere near enough to support life. Nowhere near enough to do basic bodily functions like breathing and beating of the heart and all the other stuff which is run by the human brain. Certainly not enough to have memory. Certainly not enough to have graduated with honors in mathematics. And he became called the boy with no brain. So I know some of your children about to do their TE exams, or what they call it, something else these days, the year 12 exams. Sometimes you think, you stupid boy, there's nothing between your ears. There may not be anything between his ears, but it doesn't mean he's stupid. Now I'm going to do a little experiment for you. Can you please move your head backwards and forwards? Can you hear any sloshing inside? If you could, you may also be like that boy with no brain, just full of cranial fluid. But the most interesting thing about this was it was real. There was a guy with no brain, but a mind. And the evidence is there. And there's also these people who, you know, again, who are dead, and they've still got a mind. They remember what happens when they float out of their body at a time when the brain is not functioning. The most accurate, most interesting part of that was an experiment which was done in Colorado Springs, if I remember it correctly. It was on BBC, where this woman had an aneurysm in the base of her brain. That's a blood vessel which is so weak it expands like a balloon. And if it bursts, that's a stroke, you're dead. And no one was willing to operate on her, because it's such a dangerous to get the base of the brain was just too inaccessible. No one would operate on her for fear if she died, they'd get sued. And if you get sued in the United States, it's much worse than getting sued here. But getting sued here is bad enough, so you can understand why no doctor would do it. But there was a couple of doctors. They were pioneering this this method of cryogenic freezing, where you basically freeze your body until everything stops. And then you can do all this amazing surgery, and then you warm them up again, thaw them out, and hope for the best. That's probably sort of, you know, that's my description of it. And maybe, you know, I'm not really sort of doing doctors justice, but I think you understand what I'm talking about. So that these couple of doctors said, we'll give it a try, you know, as long as you sign all these waivers that you won't sue us if you die, or rather your family won't sue us. And she had nothing to lose. She was going to die anyway. So they gave her this operation. They froze her until everything stopped. And the anaesthetist was always interested in these near-death experiences to see if people actually, if they were real or not. So he had his extra machines on her brain. And he said on this BBC, if one neuron fired, just one, my machines could pick it up. And they did. They froze her, took the top of her skull off, and actually lifted her brain right out of her head so they could get underneath, maybe stretch the cause, whatever it was, but it worked. They could tie up the aneurysm, put her brain back in the skull, no, put on the lid, tie it up. That's what it's really like, just put a lid back on your brain, and thaw her out. And, of course, it worked. That's why she could tell the tale. It's an amazing thing. You know, she survived. But during that time, when her brain was being lifted out, when it was totally frozen, so nothing was working at all, it was basically dead, she had this near-death experience. She could recall everything which happened, perfect recall, totally accurate, which actually showed there was a mind happening. Conscious memory, seeing, hearing, whatever it was, knowing was occurring when the brain was absolutely clearly dysfunctional. Now, I love telling those stories because it shows that the mind and the brain, the body, is two different things. If you want to have a nice description of what this mind is, which I mean, the thing which is this cause and effect stream, the Buddha called it the stream of consciousness. The stream keeping on flowing even after you're dead. And a greatest example of that, one of my friends at university, now he never became a monk, he got married, had kids, but you know, always go and see him whenever I go to UK. And he wrote me this letter of his daughter. This is in Opening the Door of Your Heart, but it's a brilliant story. I don't think I mentioned in the story in Opening the Door of Your Heart what happened to this girl, but I say what she did first of all, then I'll say what happened to her later on in her life. She was 5 years of age, grade one, at school, teacher trying to get sort of kids to think, started the little question, what is the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, said one little kid, you know, 5 year old. Another kid, no, miss, an elephant. An elephant is much bigger than her daddy. If the daddy was me, maybe it would be 50-50 who was the bigger. I know a lot of people keep on telling me, Ajahn Brahm, you're getting fatter and fatter and fatter. No, look, this is a reason why. I've been telling this to people, you know, all for the last couple of weeks. As a monk who's very compassionate and kind, I've been developing a big heart. You know what I'm big heart. If you develop a big heart, you have to have a big body to put it in. That's my excuse. So anyone who's really thin here, you must have a very narrow heart. Anyway, going back to what I was talking about. What was I talking about? Talking about reincarnation. Sorry? Little girl, that's thank you very much. Who's the biggest? That's your bum's tummy or the elephant's? And first for that, no, miss, a mountain. A mountain is much bigger than any of those things. And this is the 5-year-old daughter of one of my best friends from college put up her hand and said, miss, my eye is bigger than everything. My eye is the biggest thing in the world. And that really stunned everybody. And even the teacher apparently did not know what she meant. Explain, what do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? Well, miss, my eye can see her daddy. My eye can see an elephant. My eye can see a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye, my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That's absolutely brilliant. You know that that girl, the last time I visited, she was doing post-grad research, already got her PhD in biochemistry in Oxford. That's brilliant, brilliant when she was really young. Seeing things in a different way, but in a great way. And I wrote back, say, 9 out of 10, not 10 out of 10, because the human mind can see everything your eye can see. And it can imagine things you'll never see in the real world. And it can hear sounds, real and imaginary, smell, taste. And it can feel feelings and phantom feelings. And it's got its own area of knowing too. In fact, everything that can ever be known by you can fit into your mind. So the mind is the biggest thing. And you notice I never said biggest thing in the world. You can know the world. That can fit into your mind. So the mind is bigger than the world. See if you can find any fault with that argument. No one has ever countered that argument. It's just seeing it in a different way. Life, death, all of those things, the mind contains all of it. The biggest thing. Now, you get some idea of what this mind is. What drives it along? What feeds this mind? Just like, you know, in the West we had, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution. But what about the Buddhists, which is always from the very beginning, the evolution of the human mind? You might call it, if you like, the evolution of the soul. You know, Buddhists are sometimes, you know, always a bit sort of dubious about mentioning the word soul, because we're supposed to have this non-self. But what it really means, you can say there's a soul there, but it's always changing. It's never the same, one moment after the other. It's why I prefer, you know, the word of this Buddha by saying stream of consciousness as being your mind. Because the idea of a stream is very easy to understand. You can go over the Narrows Bridge. You can go over the Causeway, which are two big bridges in Perth. You can see the Swan River. You know, it looked, I came over the Narrows Bridge today. The Swan River looked exactly the same as it looked last week when I came here on a Friday. But we all know the water I saw last week is not the water I see this week. It's all flown through. It looks the same, but it's totally changed. That's what we mean by a stream of consciousness. And that's that stream of consciousness, which is basically who you take yourself to be. What drives that stream across, even in this life? Why do you go the places you want to go, do the things you want to do? Why do you make the things you want to make? You know, I've got this theory. I've got many theories. They're mostly crazy, crackpot, but who knows? Crackpot theories sometimes actually are true. Because when I studied history at school, I always wondered, why was like my home country, like England, one of the starting places for the Industrial Revolution? Why were all these great scientists in that country? What actually made it? And I noticed that at the time when the Industrial Revolution started was the same time that coffee came in to United Kingdom. And I've drank cups of coffee. Have you had cups of coffee and you get so wired you start planning and thinking of all sorts of strange stuff? That's what I thought was the start of the Industrial Revolution. Is that too much coffee and people thinking so many different things, how to make this and how to make that. I think it's caffeine was the cause of progress. And there may be something to that. Somebody should write a PhD about that. But you can see when you've had a cup of coffee and a cup of tea, you start planning this. Now you've got your house, how are you going to sort of improve this and make that and do the garden and do something else and make this. And I think if our parliament in Canberra, if we stopped them drinking coffee and tea, I think they wouldn't do so much. And therefore they wouldn't create so much problems, maybe. I don't know. But you can certainly see how people can calm down quite a lot when they don't have so much caffeine inside their blood. But when you have sort of this progress, it's always this craving a desire business. In my latest book, which is on sale for $50, it's going to be cheaper next week, but please, it's more merit this week, more good karma this week. This one of my favorite stories, which I'm going to say now, which is shows just how this craving creates things and creates our world. And this is the same force which actually pulls you or pushes you into your next life. It was a story of the bhikkhuni, the nun. You know, we've only got just monks, we've got nuns. And they're over in Gijigan, and please go and visit them. They're great nuns. They only don't come here and talk so much because there's not so many of them. They're not so senior. So we're trying to protect them like a young plant, let them nurture. until they can really come out and give lots and lots of great teachings. But this was an old story. This nun, many, many centuries ago, was living in a little cave, so happy with just a few possessions. She would take her alms bowl early in the morning, go and collect alms in the village, only a little amount of food, bring it back to her cave, eat her lunch, clean her bowl, only one meal a day, and the rest of the day was totally free for meditation, or if people came to ask questions, she was so unburdened, she could actually talk however much she wanted. Not like me, because there was a crowd of people asking questions, and I have to keep getting rid of you. Please, I'm sorry, but I do get tired. But when she came back one day from her alms round, she saw that her spare robe in the cave had been eaten by a mouse. There was a little hole in the robe. And that wasn't the first time this pesky mouse had bitten a hole in her robe. I don't know why mice do this for. There's plenty of other stuff they can make their nests out of. Actually, I was telling, we had a discussion at tea time the other day. You know, before I became a monk, you know, I had this really big hair. You know, like, is it like Jimi Hendrix style? You remember Jimi Hendrix, like, was out here, so all curly. Can I mention this? Because one day I was just resting in Kew Gardens. You know, that's a nice park over in London. I was just resting, a nice summer's day, and this duck came along and started pecking at my hair because it just wanted to make a nest out of it. And get away, duck. And it keep coming back again. And the trouble is that sometimes these animals know you're a Buddhist and can't harm them, and they take advantage of your compassion. So that's one of the reasons I've decided to shave it all off. So where was I going with this story again? Oh, the mouse, that's right. The mouse, you know, bitten a sort of a hole in the road to make a nest for itself. And this nun got really fed up. How many times do I have to patch my robes? And she had this brainwave. The light bulb came on. A cat. If I had a cat, the cat wouldn't eat the mouse. But when the mouse saw there was a cat in my cave, it wouldn't come close. So she decided to get a cat for her cave. So she went to the local village. There's many cats there. Said, can I have a cat, please? Said, yeah, sure. So they gave this nun a cat. But once she had a cat, you know, you can't just have a cat without feeding it. So she had to go a bit longer on her alms round and also ask a few of supporters, can I have a bit of milk and a bit of fish for my cat? And so she had to get some milk and some fish for her cat. And asking for all those things, especially milk, was just a bit too much. Always bothering every day, trying to get milk. So she thought, this is too much of a bother. If only I had a cow to get milk for my cat to keep away the mice, then it'd be much easier. So she had a fundraising, just like we had, you know, a few days ago. She had a fundraising to raise enough money to buy a cow. And soon she had enough money, and they bought a cow to give milk for the cat to keep the mouse away, so she didn't have to patch her robes. But now she had to look after a cow. And also, you know, cows eat grass, so she had to ask for grass every day. And all of her friends, you know, who was looking after her, had to bring lots of grass every day for this cow, and it's just too much of a burden. So she thought, no, what I really need is a field. If I had a field, if I owned a field, and just a bit of pasture for the cow, you know, to give milk for the cat to keep away the mice so my robe doesn't get sort of bitten, then it would be much easier. Oops, there goes the clock, never mind. I just always let go of time. Don't be a prisoner of time in this world. Just sometimes people ask me, you know, what the time is it? And my answer is, the time is now, minutes past now. On the nowth of the nowth month, 2000 and now. That's my time. So if anyone asks you, have you got the time? You say, yeah, it's now, minutes past now. That's the only time you have, isn't it? All this other 8:30, 9:30, whatever it is, that's just a fantasy. Anyway, back to the cow. Get a pasture. So she managed to get enough money to get a bit of land. But then, you know, you've got to sort of look after the cow, you know, fence everything and clean it up, you know, clean up the poo and everything else. And it was still a mess. And going there every day to milk the damn thing. And, oh, it's just too much trouble. So she decided what I need is a little boy, you know, like a little, not really a servant. And it won't be just, you know, just exploiting, you know, child labor. In return, you know, I'll get one of the bad boys, one of the naughty boys in the village, and I'll teach it how to be good. You know, I'll give it sort of precepts and teach it some Buddhism and meditation, so it'll be a really good boy. And in return, the boy can look after my cow. So that was an easy thing to get from the village, because amazing, there's many naughty boys around. I'm sure if I could sort of train your naughty boy or your naughty girl, you'd donate him to me straight away, no money. So they got a little boy from the village, and the boy would look after the cow, look after the pasture, which fed the cow, to give the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away so she didn't have to patch her ropes. And the boy needed a place to live, because you can't have a boy sharing the cave with a nun. You know, that's almost like paedophilia or whatever. So they had to get a little hut for the boy outside the cave. And so she had to find wood and bricks and stuff to make a hut. And that was really getting difficult. And she was so busy asking for wood to build a house, to look after the boy, who would look after the field, to feed the cow, who give milk, for the cat, to keep away the mouse. She was so busy doing all of this that when someone asked her, you know, can you please explain this problem in meditation? She said, I'm sorry, I'm too busy. I got to see the carpenters who are building their house for the boy to look after the field in which the cow lives, to get milk for the cat, to keep away the mouse in my cave. And then she realized just how craving and wanting had just ruined her whole life. So what did she do? She just told the boy to go home. Told all the villagers, take away the wood of this house. She sold the field and gave it to charity. Let someone look after the cow. She gave the cat away. And now she didn't have anything at all. And the next day when she'd given everything away, she felt so peaceful. And she went on arms round. And when she came back, she found another hole in her rope. The mice had come back, but it had only taken 5 minutes to patch up. It was much easier than looking after a boy, to look after the field, to look after the cow, to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away. Now you can see how craving and desire moves you along, creating things. How many of you have big houses? You're absolutely crazy having big houses. Why do you have a big house? Just because everybody else does. You're sheep. Ba, ba, ba. Just get a small house. An apartment is really neat. And I keep on saying, in big houses, it separates a family. You know, your son has one room. Your daughter has another room. Your wife has her room, you have your room. You never meet each other. You never see each other. And just when it gets round to doing the housework, it takes you ages to do housework. Imagine just like 2 rooms. You know, one for your family to sleep in, the other one for the kids to sleep in. You can cook there and eat there. You see each other. Now, for those of you, I was saying this, that for those of you who ever go to stay in Jhana Grove, those cottages there, I worked it out. You can probably get about 3 or 4 of the little apartments where I grew up in with my dad, my mum, my brother, 4 of us in a tiny space. It was tiny, very easy to clean up. And also, it meant I could never escape from my mother, my father, my brother. So yeah, we would fight sometimes, but there was no place to escape. We had to make up afterwards. That's where I learnt love, getting on with other people. You know, when you have your own areas, your own spaces where you can hide, it means you don't learn forgiveness, love, you know, letting go of the past, because you had to let go. Had no choice, there's no place to go to. Small houses rock. They're really good for love. Yeah, you've got no personal space. But do you really want personal space, or do you want love? Being respected, having friends, having family. People you grow up with, really close to, because you live close to them. You can save a lot of money that way. So, simplicity. So what we're doing here, why is it? What is it which propels us always to want bigger things, always want more stuff, always to keep moving forward and never staying still and enjoying what we've got? Why do you work so hard? Good question, isn't it? I'm working so hard for my kids. No, you're not. If you really want kids to be happy, downsize. Spend more time with them. So anyway, this is like the force. You can see the force which makes you do such things. That force keeps on going on throughout your whole life, always moving on to the next thing. I call that craving. Even this weekend, what are you doing this weekend? How many of you are doing nothing? Having a nothing weekend? Can you do that? You feel guilty. No, I'm supposed to be doing something. Why, for goodness sake? How about I challenge you to do 1 hour, just only 1 hour this weekend, of doing absolutely nothing. Sitting in a chair, not watching the TV, that's doing something. Not reading a book, that's doing something. Not writing or sending emails, that's doing something. Sitting down and doing absolutely nothing. Not even meditating. Meditating is doing something. Sitting down, doing absolutely nothing. Just being here. Can you do that? Ha ha ha. No, you can't. We're always in life, always going somewhere. Going on to the next thing. That's why some of my stories here. He's not here this evening, but I was busy one day, I think on a Saturday afternoon, he usually comes on a Saturday, carrying sort of some papers into the office to do something. And he asked me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, how are you? You know what I said? I made a big mistake. I say, I'm getting there. And he asked me, where are you getting to? He caught me out. At least I was honest with him. I said, I'm getting to Karakata, Fremantle or Pinneroo, one of the three. That's where I'm going to. That's where you're going to as well. It just depends on what you're doing before you get there. For those of you overseas, those are the three crematoriums, cemeteries in Perth. That's the only place anyone's getting to. You're getting to the cemetery. So I decided that's not a nice thing to say. So I said, no, I'm never going to answer that again in the same way. When anyone says, how are you? I'm going to say, I'm being here. Isn't that a much better answer? Isn't that telling you, instead of always going somewhere else, getting on to the next thing, how about you spend some time just being here for a change? What I've been saying very recently, I think I said this even last week, how many human beings are there here today? Very few. There's many human goings. Very few human beings. They're very rare in this world today, always going somewhere. So that's what happens. That's what drives us from one life to the next. We're always going somewhere, always going on to the next thing. That's that craving. That is the karma, which always pushes us onto something else. That is the very force which pushes you onto a new life. When you're dead, you're not finished yet. You still want something more. You're still going somewhere. You just can't stop. And wherever you want to go, especially when you get to that part of your life, the death, that is really, really strong. In this world, we're so limited by this really heavy body. It is heavy. Anybody who's died, actually, which is everybody here, and you forgot it, stupid. If you can only remember what it's like to be dead, it's like you're light. You can float. You haven't got this heavy body which keeps on restricting you. That's why many people have this out-of-body experience, temporary death. They feel so free. They're not restricted by this heavy, lumpy body. And I'm not just talking about me. Your body's lumpy too. That's what it feels like. So, especially when you get to that place of, they call it a mind-made body. Now, sometimes people call it the astral body and just, New Age stuff. But this is 2,500 years ago, basic early Buddhism called it mind made body. This is what you make afterwards, who you think you are. And you go to where you want to go. You do what you want to do. This is why that many people have those experiences of ghosts. People who come and just make sure everything's okay. Don't be afraid of ghosts. One of the beautiful ghost stories which somebody here told me, and it's a fascinating one because it's not like a man ghost. It's not a female ghost. It was the dog ghost. Now, why not? Can dogs be ghosts? Yes, they can. I don't know if she's here this evening, but she said she lived over in the hills somewhere, and she had a dog which was like, you know, her best friend. Just the two of them lived together. There's no other person. I think her husband died years ago. So she had a dog and her, you know, together, loved each other to bits. Every morning and evening they go on a walk in the forest, you know, close to where they lived, up in the hills in Perth. And one day when she came back after the walk, she realized she'd lost her finger ring in the forest. Not an expensive finger ring, but it had huge emotional value, you know, from where it came from, who gave it to her. So she turned around and tried to find her ring. And you know how difficult it is, you know, with all the leaves and the twigs in the forest. It's impossible to find. But she tried for a couple of hours with her dog, couldn't find it at all. So reluctantly and sadly, she gave it up for lost. These things happen in life. She forgot about that the next day when her dog died. And she was heartbroken. You know, the dog she'd known so long. Those of you had a dog which dies, you know it's just not a small thing. But she told me, sitting here in front some years ago, she swore to me that she could hear her dog bark in her house. She said it was him, it was that dog, or her, I forget which one it was. But you know, if that's your dog, you've lived with it for such a long time, you know your dog's bark. You can recognize it, just like you know human speech. You've gone so close, you spent so much time, you said, that was my dog. But she could never see it. Now, she was in one room, the dog was in another room. She opened the door and there was no one there. But one day, after 4 or 5 days, she heard the dog right outside the front door of her house, and she was just on the inside of the front door. And she heard it, and she opened the front door as quickly as she could, hoping to have one last sight of her darling dog. There's no dog there. But right in the very center of the welcome mat was her ring. She'd been in the house before, no ring. Now it had appeared after the dog barked. And that was the last bark she heard from her dog. The dog had found her ring. True story. Isn't that wonderful? That's really quite sweet. So, ghost dogs, they do exist. They do what they need to do, and then they can move on. And sometimes that's what we do when we die. That's what keeps pushing the stream of consciousness to fulfill unfinished business. And that is actually what keeps us sort of moving on in life, in this life, and moving on from life to life. Unfinished business. Is your business all finished yet? How on earth can you finish your business? Even right now, if you had only 1 or 2 days to die, wouldn't you find it difficult to get all your business done in 1 or 2 days? You'd probably apply for an extension. I can't do it 1 or 2 days, doctor. Please give me another few days to live. What was that story about? The guy went to, this is an old joke, but it's been a year or 3 months I haven't given talks, so hopefully you remembered all the you've forgotten all the jokes from last year. Guy goes to see the doctor. The doctor says, "You're terrible cancer. I'm sorry to tell you, it's terminal and you've only got 7 days to live." And the man said, "Only 7 days, doctor? I don't think I can pay your bill within 7 days. Okay, I'll give you 2 weeks to live then." We've got to find the money somewhere to feed these kids. I thought that was a funny joke. Okay, if you don't think that's a funny joke, another doctor joke, which I heard. Then this is a new one, so you wouldn't have heard this last year. about the guy who wakes up after an operation in Charlie Gardner's hospital. He wakes up and he complains he's got a splitting headache and he's got a swelling on his head. And he complains to the nurse, look, you know, I feel terrible, splitting headache, swelling on my head. And the nurse said, it can't be because you've had a stomach operation. You know, we didn't even touch your head. No, it's tummy and it's supposed to be a success. He said, but look, you know, feel my head, it's a terrible headache. And the nurse feels his head, it actually is a swelling up there. So she goes to see the surgeon who did the, you know, the bowel operation. And said, there must be something complication there. He's got a really cracking headache and he's got a swelling on his head. And the doctor said, oh, I know the cause of that. You know, because of, you know, financial problems, we ran out of anesthetic halfway through the operation. So we had to... Please be careful in public hospitals because the government are cutting costs wherever they can. But anyway, this craving, this desire is what pushes you on to another life. Because you've got unfinished business. How can you finish your business in this life? It's very easy. It's this beautiful irresponsibility. The story of this great monk in Thailand died many years ago. And he was building his hut. No, not his hut, his hall in his monastery. It came to the rains retreat. We just finished it now. During our rains retreat, 3 months, we don't do anything except teaching, but we don't do any building. Just basic maintenance, that's all. 3 months, you know, just the meditation and teaching. So when it started, he sent all the builders home. Go home, you can come back in another 3 months. And a visitor came a few days later. And he asked the monk, he said, when is the hall going to be finished? Like, you know, Dhammasara Monastery, we're raising funds for, you say, when is it going to be finished? Well, you know, after it started, we haven't really started it yet, but it's going to start soon. And when is it going to be finished? And this monk said, it is finished. Pardon me? It's finished, said the monk. What do you mean? There's no roof on it. There's no glass in the windows. There's cement bags all over the place. What do you mean? It's finished. And the monk said, sir, what's done is finished. And then he went off to meditate. Now that is wisdom. What's done is finished. So have you finished this weekend? Yeah, what's done is finished. Tomorrow when you get up in the morning, you know, you can ask, the wife asks you, darling, have you mown the lawn yet? Say, darling, what's done is finished. You know, be careful there because I did get into big trouble once. Really big trouble. Sri Lankan family, I gave that story years ago. A Sri Lankan family came to see me on Sunday morning. And they said, we come to complain about your talk, Ajahn Brahm. So what have I done this time? And they said, last night, Saturday night, our son, doing year 12, okay, our son, we asked him, he said, are you going out? He said, yeah, I'm going out. Have you finished your homework? Because we made a deal, you finish your homework first and then you can go out. And their son said, just as Ajahn Brahm said, Dad, what's done is finished, see you tomorrow. He hadn't done his homework. But no, seriously, that's an incredible, powerful statement there. Otherwise, nothing is ever finished in your life. There's always loose ends. There's always more to be done. There's always more things you want, more places you can go. Apparently these days, when before people die, they have these things. I don't know where the phrase came from, a bucket list. Why is it called bucket list? I know when you die, it's called kicking the bucket. Has it got something to do with that? Has it, really? Okay. But anyway, bucket list. They want to go and see Niagara Falls, the Great Wall of China, the Amazon rainforest, to see Mount Everest, and goodness knows what else. And I keep telling people, what do you want to do that for? If you want to see a waterfall, turn on the shower. If you want to see a mountain, go to Mount Lawley or Mount Hawthorne. If you want to, you want to see a Great Wall of China, you know, cause there's a wall out there, for goodness sake. A wall's a wall. Was a big deal. So some of these, why do you want to do these things for? Because It's what you're supposed to do. How many of you really think what I want to do and do that instead of what you expected to do? And that's the biggest problem in our life. We are so conditioned to do what other people expect us to do. Not what we want to do, not what we found really important. One of the reasons, look, whenever there's a long weekend, I see this because I live down south. See all these people, thousands of them, they go down south to get away with from everybody. They don't get away. If you want to get away from people, stay here on a long weekend. No one's in Perth. It's going to be a really nice time. You're crazy. Because they always follow what other people do instead of stopping and thinking for yourself. When you don't follow what other people do, it's not conditioned anymore. This is the problem. We're conditioned to follow other people. That's why we keep on going on and on and on. We never stop. Nothing's ever finished. So even in death, we're not finished yet. Because you're not finished, you get reborn. Basically, that's a force which keeps you going. It's the same force which means you can't just take an hour of rest now. Which is one reason, if you want to stop rebirth, learn how to rest. Learn how to stop. Learn how to be still. And if at the moment of death, you can be so still, say what's done is finished, then when the bus which is going to take you to your next life passes, they can't see you. You're too still. Where is she? And it leaves without you. You ended. No more birth. Hoo-hoo. Do you really want to get reborn again? Do you really want to spend the first year of your life with someone stuck in this dummy in your mouth when you're trying to sort of say something? Do you really want to go to school? Do you really want to wear nappies again? And go to school all over again? You know, do sums and stuff like that? Haven't you had enough? Some people say, yes, I want to do it all over again. Because they think, next time, I'll do it right. No, that's what you said last time. And this is that next time. It's true. So that's actually what keeps you forcing. We think the next time we'll do it better. That's why people keep getting married again. They think the next one will be the right one. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you do meet Mrs. Wright. When you get married, you find out why she's called Mrs. Wright. Because she always thinks she's right. Okay, so that's what forces you on from life to life. And that's how it's... Now that is, with a few jokes and a bit sort of using modern language, that is basic dependent origination. Karma and craving, conditioning, and desire keeping on forcing you from life to life as it's doing in this life. Sometimes you ask yourself, just like that bhikkhuni, that nun, why am I doing this? That is where you start getting wisdom. Please challenge. Don't be a sheep. Challenge. Think for yourself. One of my favorite sayings, and really that if ever I found a university with a decent sort of motto, this would be it. Where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And there's too many people think the same, even a Buddhist society. Please think differently. Challenge. Question. That's one of the great things I liked about this teaching. You're always allowed to question. Nothing was dogmatic. Question, 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 question. Don't always just think the same. And if you can do that, you can maybe stop. Be still. And when you're still, there's a whole force which keeps driving you, to find a cat, to keep the mouse away, and then a cow to feed the cat, and then a field to look after the cow and a boy, all of that sort of stuff. You can start to see that's what creates more life. You think, what do I want to do that for? I'm going to just live simply, be peaceful. And there maybe I can find contentment at last. No longer being a human going onto your next life or into your next destination, wherever that happens to be, but be a human being. Someone who stops because what's done is finished. Da da da. And that's the talk for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it, at least some of the humour, if not some of the deep stuff, which is really embedded in there. So thank you for listening. And now we will have, oh, the time come back again. Thank you. Very good. The Grim Reaper, the Lord of Time. The Grim Reaper comes in strange disguises these days. So we got any questions from overseas? Okay. And then any questions from here? Because one day people complain that if they want to ask a question, they have to live overseas. And locals, especially people actually listening to the talk, can't answer a question. So once there was a question actually came over here. And it was, they said, from Malaysia or from some weird place. It was actually somebody sitting over there who got on there and they made it up. Just so they can get a question answered. Anyway. Oh, this is Wing Nee from Melbourne. This is not that far away, just from the far east, Melbourne. Dear Ajahn, my friend's dad had stroke 2 weeks ago and now in coma. He underwent an operation and is still unconscious. She tried talking to her dad, but she could not feel him there anymore. Being the eldest daughter, she has been asked to make the decision. She has decided to keep the life support on for another week, and then they will bring him home. It's a big decision for her. She's feeling unsure and scared. Can Ajahn please advise? Oh, this is one of those questions. I've answered this many times before, but there you are. It's your wife, your husband, your parent, maybe your child, your lover. Maybe it doesn't actually work for a lover, but if it's somebody close to you, they're in a coma, a stroke or some accident, and the doctor comes up to you and says, you're the next of kin, should I turn the machine off? How do you answer that? You don't want to kill your mum, but then you want to care for her. And it's not that difficult thing to do. All you really need to do, and this is a practical thing because many people have heard this and they practice it, you go next to your mum or your dad or whoever it happens to be in that coma and you just stand by them for a while and ask, is anyone there? And you'll be able to know and feel if someone is there or not. Because it's totally different when they're actually gone. There's a family of Vietnamese, I don't know if they're here this evening. Their father or the matriarch's husband had a heart bypass which didn't work, so it was in ICU and they asked me to go there. And I don't know how I managed to do this. I think 3 times a day for about 6 or 7 days I went to see him. The reason I did is because he really was on the edge. I could feel that. Just go by his bedside. He was almost losing it. Give some chanting, some boost of energy. And then I could feel him. He was actually lifting. And then he would go down again. I'd come back and give him another lift of energy. And I really thought, with a bit more he could probably pull through. But they called me one day. And I went there to see him again, and it felt totally different. I said, look, it's a waste of time. You're chanting. He's gone. You could feel there's no one there anymore. And I taught that to other people. That's not my relation. If that's your relation, you've got a much closer contact. You can feel whether they're there or not. But I always remember that occasion because I've been there for about 10 or 12 times, maybe not more than that, in the ICU. So the doctors and nurses, they recognized me. They knew who I was. And when I said this time, I said, he's gone. I remember seeing the doctor and nurse looking at me. Yes, yes. They knew it. I don't know how they knew it, but, I could just suss that out just by being sensitive, as you can as well. And if you think there's no one there, all you're really doing is stopping the life support. They've already gone. Their stream of consciousness has left the body and they're away. The opposite of that is that sometimes they're still there. And sometimes even the doctor doesn't know it, but you will know it. And the opposite of that was one of the people. She was in a coma. She told the story. And there we go. So this particular person, that means we're speaking from a coma. That must be the mother. No, this person was actually in a coma. And she came out of it afterwards, and she described what it's like being in a coma. Because, she managed to come out of it, and this is actually what happened to her. She said she was in a really dark place. That's how she experienced it, so dark. And then what brought her out of that really dark place, she said a tinkling of bells. And that know, to a meditator is so accurate because it's sound which actually brings you out from the deep comas, much more than touch. So if you want to bring out your mum from the coma, talk to her. Because if it's sound which she recognizes, that will bring her consciousness back. And so then she could, back in her body, she could feel her body, she could hear and she could see, but she couldn't move anything, especially not speak. And so she was sitting there, or laying down there for a little while, and then she could see her sons, she saw the doctor come up, and the doctor was asking the sons, look, your mother is gone, can we turn off the machines? And the mothers, no, she wanted to say, I'm not gone, I'm here, stupid, keep me alive. And being a Chinese family, this, you know, the four sons, the three younger sons said, it's the eldest son's responsibility. You make the decision. And he hated that decision. Just one person taking that huge responsibility. And the woman said she was willing her son, please don't turn off the machines. Don't. I'm still here. And he said, keep her going another day. Thank you, son. Thank you, son. This is what she related later on. And in that next 24 hours, she started to move, you know, her hands, just a slight bit. Enough for the doctor to realize she was still alive and that she was getting better. And it took her a year or two to actually get her full faculties back, but she did. But it's interesting, she said, just what happened. Sometimes the doctor doesn't know. But if you're the daughter, the son, you know. All you need to do is to ask, make your mind peaceful and calm, and feel. Never, ever underestimate that. You call it intuition. It's not female intuition or men's intuition or monk's intuition. We all have it. We just need to tune into it, and we'll know. You'll know whether turning off the life support is just killing somebody, or whether it's just, you know, stopping the person who's already dead from keeping on just artificially breathing and pumping the heart. You'll know that. And that's such an important thing. It solves a lot of problems. So if that ever happens to you, and you're sort of the person who has to make that final decision, just ask for a few minutes alone with that person in the coma, in the ICU. Ask for a few minutes alone. Ask the question, is anyone there? And it's amazing just how clear the answer will be. There's no one there, they're gone. Then you can turn off the machine, it's no problem. So practical, it actually works. The similar question, which I'm just going to add here, that's a dog. Doctor says, your dog has got bad cancer. I need to euthanize it. There's no chance of survival. What do you do? On the one hand, you love your dog to bits. On the other hand, you know, you don't want to sort of kill it. You don't want to see it suffer either. What should you do? Answer, ask the dog. Ask the doc, the vet, can I please have a couple of minutes alone with my dog? Ask a question. Look into its eyes. Do you want to go? Have you had enough? Or do you want to carry on? She's not here today, but remember Judy? Judy Rushforth? You know, she did this, and there's a classic case. Her little dog, bad cancer, treated with the vet many times. She took it to the vet one last time. The vet said, look, it's a hopeless case. I've got to put it down. And she said, now I'm going to follow. Now, can I have a couple of minutes alone? And she tried my method. She asked her dog, looked into its eyes, and this is the dog she loved. Now, do you want to go? Do you want to die? Have you had enough? And she got the very clear message back, no, it didn't want to be put down. And so she told the vet, said, no, I'm taking it home. And the vet was so angry at her. And are you selfish, cruel Buddhist? You know, you'd say you're compassionate and stuff, but that dog is hurting. I've got to put it down. No, I'm taking it home. So she took it home. 3 months later, she took the dog back to the vet. It had made a full recovery. And the vet was amazed. You Buddhists are very wise and compassionate. It works. And many people have done that, and they've told me those stories. That's just one of them. The dog knows, and it's a dog's choice whether it's had enough, wants to be put down. And if you look at the dog, and the dog, you can see it's had enough. We did that. We had a cat at Bodhinyana Monastery who had cancer of the nose. We gave it many treatments, And the very end, I was here on the weekend when the monks were looking after it, and actually they actually asked the cat. It was actually, I think, Santuti did that. Was it you, Chunda? It was Santuti. He picked up the cat and asked it, you know, have you had enough? And the cat actually nodded. So Santuti told me that. Had enough, so took it to the vet to have it be injected, put down. It's a cat's choice. It's not yours. Fascinating. When you communicate with animals, you can, if it's your pet, and just ask a question, you can communicate with a person in the coma. It's not that hard to do. And that means it saves a lot of heartache and questions and doubt what you should do. Okay, that's Wing Li. There's only one question from overseas. Maybe it's not working for overseas, only Melbourne. Any questions from the floor about the today's talk? Going, going. Okay, we can finish off now. So we're going to pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, those who wish to, and then we can go and have a cup of tea, whatever you want to do.